Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past, recited Winston Smith in Orwell's 1984. Nowadays, news media have a good deal of control over our knowledge and understanding of the past. The 4th of July weekend will doubtless feature media chatter about what America stands for and how our history has shaped us. But much of that talk will bear little relationship to the country's actual history, which is roughly a million times more complicated and conflict-riddled than the image we're usually presented, a more or less steady march of progress, with perhaps a few bumps in the road. Someone who's thought a lot about how we mislearn history and how that shapes our political life is James W. Loewen. He's the author of the classic book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, for which he assessed the textbooks used in U.S. classrooms, turning up falsehoods, elisions, and distortions, along with some of the reasons students say they hate history and non-white students hate it most of all. For Independence Day, then, an extended interview with author and professor James Loewen, coming up. There are a number of ways that corporate news media abuse history. One of them is false attribution. Once an historical figure has built up a certain amount of respect and authority with the public, it's helpful to, you know, pretend they said things, whether or not they actually did. So, no, Abraham Lincoln never said, "You cannot help the poor by destroying the rich." That's a part of a so-called Ten Cannots, often attributed to Lincoln on talk radio and by conservative pundits. You cannot strengthen the weak by weakening the strong. You cannot help little men by tearing down big men. You get the idea. They're the actual words of William J.H. Betker, a conservative minister who published them in 1916, in a pamphlet along with some actual Lincoln quotes. But that didn't stop Rush Limbaugh, former Republican National Committee Chair Michael Steele, and Ronald Reagan, among others, from putting those words in Lincoln's mouth. Michael Steele later shifted to say he learned them from his mother. A very efficient way to distort history is to erase some events altogether. That's the approach Time magazine took when they offered readers an infographic to explain U.S. relations with Iran. Readers were told that the history of hostilities began in 1979 when Iran called the U.S. the Great Satan and took American hostages. Iranians and people with memories, though, would almost certainly choose a different starting point. Say 1953, when the U.S. helped orchestrate a coup that ousted Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. We can say this now, the CIA has admitted it. Or one might point to the U.S. support for Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the war with Iran that spanned most of the 1980s. The U.S. offered intelligence support, for example, for Iraqi chemical weapons attacks on Iran. In 1988, a U.S. cruiser shot down Iran Air Flight 665, killing 290 civilian passengers on board. But Time leaves out all of those events. Though they do include one time in 2000 when Bill Clinton tried but failed to meet the Iranian president in New York. This is how media's effort to make the United States look good at all costs can take a story beyond inadequate to incoherent, since making sense of U.S.-Iran relations today without knowing the actual history is literally impossible. And finally, it's not just events that get nipped and tucked and twisted to suit corporate media priorities. It's people, too. The textbook example there would be Martin Luther King Jr. Every January, we get a story about King with footage. He battled segregation in Birmingham. He had a dream of racial harmony. He marched for voting rights, and then he died. Virtually always, the story flushes the last years of King's life down the memory hole. That was the time he challenged the country's fundamental priorities, arguing that civil rights laws were empty without human and economic rights, and that the U.S. in Vietnam and elsewhere was showing itself the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. So erased is this information that today's press corps can print without challenge the claims of certain commentators that King would oppose affirmative action or that he would have discouraged protests over racist law enforcement. Here's something Martin Luther King actually said at Ebenezer Baptist Church in 1967. Quote, America and most of its newspapers applauded me in Montgomery, and I stood before thousands of Negroes getting ready to riot when my home was bombed and said, we can't do it this way. They applauded us in the sit-in movement. We nonviolently decided to sit in at lunch counters. They applauded us on the freedom rides when we accepted blows without retaliation. They praised us in Albany and Birmingham and Selma, Alabama. Oh, the press was so noble in its applause and so noble in its praise when I was saying, be nonviolent toward Bull Connor, when I was saying, be nonviolent toward Jim Clark. There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say, be nonviolent toward Jim Clark, but will curse and damn you when you say, be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children. There's something wrong with that press. Close quote. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. When things happen, like the murder of 9 African Americans in a Charleston church by a white man who believes they have no place in the country, we often hear expressions like, this doesn't look like America, or this is a sad hearkening back to a time long past. We don't all say that, though. For some people, and not only black people, it's quite clear that this, too, is America and the present. There will always be contested ideas about national identity, but part of the reason we can have almost entirely separate conversations has to do with the way we learn and use history in the United States, and particularly the history of the United States. We'll be hearing lots of tossed-off references to what the founders intended and what America represents to the world over the Independence Day holiday. It seems a particularly appropriate time to talk about how we talk about U.S. history and how that affects the politics and priorities of 2015. We're pleased to be joined now by James W. Lowen, professor of sociology at the University of Vermont, author of the classic Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, among other titles including Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, and The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, James Lowen.
Hey, I'm glad to be with you.
Well, let's begin in South Carolina. While the move surely has to do with optics or public relations, it's hard not to find significance in the fact that possibly another generation of kids might not grow up with a Confederate flag flying over the place where their laws are made. It seems as though there is some kind of grappling going on with what the Confederate flag meant and still means. As you hear conversations about heritage, not hate, what do you see as some of the leftover, the most enduring myths or misconceptions about the Confederacy?
Sure. Well, let me say, first of all, that I think it is very important that Governor Haley came out against the flag and that it looks like it's going to succeed, that the flag will come down from this place of honor right in front of the state capitol. Of course, a while back, it did come down from on top of the state capitol, which is just an astounding placement if you think about it, because it implies, you know, the flag flying right over the place where the laws are made certainly implies that the laws are made in obedience to what that flag means. So let's look for just a minute at what that flag means, because unfortunately, most of the people who are right now flip-flopping on the flag, and again, it's wonderful that they are reversing themselves. But most of them still don't have the, well, either the knowledge, perhaps, or certainly the guts to actually say that they've been getting it wrong all these years, and they need to say what the flag stands for. The Confederacy seceded, many people think, for states' rights. And I know they think this because for the last, at least 7 years, and certainly for the last 5 years while we've been in the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, I've been going around the country asking them, why did the South secede? Now, this is the most important thing that ever happened in the history of this country because, of course, the secession of the South and its firing on various forts, particularly Fort Sumter, led immediately to the Civil War, which is far and away the most important thing that ever happened after we organized as a country. So this is very important. Why did they do it? And you always get four answers. You get the South seceded for slavery. It seceded for states' rights. It seceded because of the election of Lincoln. And it seceded over tariffs and taxes, or issues about tariffs and taxes. And then I ask people to vote. And what's interesting is it doesn't make any difference whether I'm asking them in Columbia, South Carolina, where I have, or Greensboro, North Carolina, where I have, or in North Dakota, where I have, or an overwhelmingly black audience in Memphis, where I have, or in Southern California. The answer comes out almost always the same. And here's how it comes out. About 15%, sometimes 20%, say the South seceded over slavery. 60% say, sometimes 65, say the South seceded for states' rights. About 2% say the South seceded because of the election of Lincoln. And about 10 to 30%, this is the one that varies the most, say that it was all about issues about tariffs and taxes. So then we look at the facts, and it's very interesting. The facts are perfectly easy to find. You mentioned my book, The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader. Well, they're all in there, and they weren't that hard for us to find when we put them in there. The most important single statement is by South Carolina because it seceded first. But every single statement, every single state makes a similar statement when it leaves the United States. Here's what South Carolina called its statement. Quote, Declaration of the immediate causes which induce and justify the secession of South Carolina from the Federal Union. That kind of sounds right on point, doesn't it?
Yes.
And here's what they say. They actually say, we assert that 14 of the states have deliberately refused for years past to fulfill their constitutional obligations, and we refer to their own statutes for the proof. Now, constitutional obligations sounds kind of vague, but they go right on to tell us exactly what they mean. The Constitution of the United States, in its fourth article, provides as follows, quote, no person held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim to of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. Well, that's, of course, the Fugitive Slave Clause. And they then go on to tell us which states are exercising their states' rights in various little ways and making various little interferences. They say the states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, blah, 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 they name 16 of them in all, ending up in the West with Wisconsin and Iowa, have enacted laws which either nullify the acts of Congress or render useless any attempt to execute them. In many of these states, the fugitive is discharged from the service or labor clause. So, in other words, it is all about states' rights, except the South is against states' rights. And what it's really all about is, of course, slavery, the S word.
It's so difficult, though, to confront that. Why? I'm shocked, actually, at the lowness of the percentage that respond with the answer of slavery. I would have thought that would have at least been a contender.
20%. And that's 20% if you ask in Seattle. You know, it doesn't make any – Cleveland.
Right, right.
So – we completely misunderstand the most important thing that ever happened in the country. Now, why do we misunderstand it? Well, I'm going to give you two reasons. First thing we need to do, any historian will tell you, we need to look at when we started to misunderstand it. And we didn't misunderstand it at the time. How could we? Mississippi, Texas, every single state says it's slavery. That's why we're leaving. So we didn't misunderstand it then. We started misunderstanding it mostly between 1890 and 1940. And this is the era that historians call the nadir of race relations. Nadir is, of course, an English language word meaning low point. Some people say nadir. That's fine, too. So during this era, 1890 to 1940, the United States goes more racist in its thinking, in its ideology, than at any other point. This is when lynchings reach their all-time high. This is when so many towns across the North go sundown. That is, they throw out their black populations, or they, if they don't have any, they make a decision formally or informally that they're never going to have any. And they post, some of them post infamous signs at their city limits, like Manitowoc, Wisconsin, saying, quote, nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in Manitowoc, unquote. So at this point, when the neo-Confederates start saying, no, 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 it wasn't about slavery, it was all about states' rights, the white North really doesn't have the gumption to argue with them because they're participating in racism so heavily themselves. So that's one explanation. But the other explanation is to look at today's textbooks. And one I like to pick on is the largest textbook ever invented for middle school in this country. It's called The American Journey. It's by three it's a history of the United States. It's allegedly by three famous historians, Joyce Appleby, Alan Brinkley, and James McPherson. And so you would think that the stuff on the Civil War would be by McPherson, because he wrote what I think is the best single-volume history of the Civil War. But when you read it, it turns out it completely mystifies what secession was all about. Mm-hmm. Now, McPherson knows. So what we know from this is, it turns out, that these people who allegedly write the history textbooks don't write them. The publishers write them, and then they rent their names and stick them on them. But they don't even read them. Now, I mean, I tell, when I'm lecturing about this kind of thing to college students, I say, now look, if you are such an idiot that you actually buy your term paper for $9.95 from the web, I hope you at least have the brains to read the darn thing before you hand it in to your teacher. So I know that James McPherson never even read what he says about secession in this book because he'd never put up with it.
He knows better.
Yes.
Well, one of the things that erasing that Nader period does, I mean, one of the problems with the way that's integrated is we have this idea that history has been a steady improvement,
yeah,
a steady march,
yeah,
toward
exactly,
progress. We can't really process the idea that it's looped back and things have gotten worse. And
that's right. That's,
yeah,
right. We don't, and that's the basic storyline. People often ask me, okay, so you wrote this book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. What's the biggest lie? And that's the biggest lie, that we started out great and we've been getting better ever since, kind of automatically. And now you people should vote, but that's about all you really need to do, because otherwise the history, you know, things take care of themselves. And of course, it's unfortunately, it's not true. Things don't take care of themselves. We have to take care of them. And I honestly believe that we are beginning to take care of this idiotic pro-Confederate mythology right now as we speak.
And that is hopeful. I mean, we shouldn't almost need to spell out part of what's so problematic about this steady march of progress is that it says to people who are outside of power, who are disadvantaged,
yeah,
today,
be passive.
You know, your ancestor, you say at one point in Lies, you know, the message of textbooks to non-white kids is often, well, your ancestors didn't do very much. And so you're,
yeah,
probably not going to do very much. That's a real message.
And furthermore, just be passive, because it's all going to take care of itself.
Right. Right. Well, do you believe, I know that you have gone back and taken a look at textbooks more recently than you initially did, and I understand,
yes,
you think that maybe the treatment of slavery, the way it's taught to kids, has improved somewhat?
No. Well, of course it has improved, mm-hmm, compared to, say, what we said about slavery during the Nader.
Right. Sure.
But the textbooks of the period, the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, already, I have to admit, except for one of them, did make slavery not so good, you know, which is good, because in the 50s, even into the 60s, they made slavery sound pretty good. You know, maybe you might want to be a slave yourself. People take care of you and stuff, and you don't have to worry about what to do next. They'll tell you,
yeah,
and which is just a completely inadequate, shall we say, view of slavery.
Absolutely.
So they corrected that, but they eliminated the R word, that is, racism. And the problem is, of course, we ended slavery. I mean, we really did. We have to admit that, yes, we still have enslaved prisoners. And there's certainly the fact that there was a lot of prisoner enslavement in the 1890s and during the Nader. But as a whole, we did end slavery. We did pass the 13th Amendment and so on. So it's a great country. We fixed it. But the R word, the racism, which is, of course, the handmaiden of slavery, which grows up to accompany slavery, which rationalizes it and makes it seem appropriate, that didn't just disappear with the passage of the 13th Amendment. We still have that problem, and as I indicated, it even intensified during the Nader. And it is that we're still dealing with today. Now, I keep being an optimist, and I think that getting rid of these statues will help, because I think if you've got a Confederate statue at your county seat, and it says the Confederacy was wonderful, I think it's easier for you to grow up with a Confederate mindset and maybe even a Confederate heart. So I'm hoping that we go beyond just removing the flag and end up either taking these silly statues down all the way from Helena, Montana to deepest Florida and putting them in a museum, or if we leave them up, put right next to them a plaque that explains what's wrong with them.
Well, journalism is a kind of a text, too. Both kind of represent how we, choosing that word carefully, how we tell a story when we want to tell it simply, you know. And there are similar failings, I find. There's a passive voice. There are truncated timelines that imply a causality. And then one of you, another thing you were just reminding me of, which is that we tell history and current events through the story of big men, you know, of famous people. And I think it dovetails with this idea about eliminating racism from the conversation. In the book, you talk about how if we would have an honest depiction of just, say, Abraham Lincoln, we would see how somebody can grapple with an idea, can
That's
change
right.
their ideas over
That's
the
right.
course of their life. And we would see that racism is not a solid object that exists inside some people.
That's right.
You know, we'd have an active idea of how history is made.
That's right. Abraham Lincoln was, of course, a racist. And he also was an anti-racist. And so are we all, I submit. And if we can understand that in him, then we can understand that we are not fixed with our ideas. And I think we have a current example right in front of us. How many of us have changed our ideas just in the last 20 years about whether gay people should be disparaged, whether they should be allowed to get married? If we can change our ideas on these things, we can change our ideas on race as well.
Well, we're going to be hearing about the 4th of July soon when, as I understand it, white men in wigs got together and thought up democracy. And they had some influences, but mostly they just had this spirit of egalitarianism. One important influence on the ideas of governing is not generally part of the conversation. And I wonder if you could talk to listeners a little bit about the Iroquois League, because I bet we're not going to hear about that.
Sure. It wasn't even only the Iroquois.
Right.
Many Native American nations or tribes, whatever term you want to use, and some Native Americans prefer tribe, just for the record, many of these groups were much more egalitarian than anything that the Western Europeans knew when they first got to these shores in 1492, in 1607, or whatever group we're talking about before or after that. And so it kind of amazed them. How can they govern themselves? Some of them, like the Choctaws, governed about half of Mississippi and maybe an eighth of Alabama. So that's a pretty big area. That's a bigger area than whole nations in Europe. And they're doing it without any king. How can they do that? And, of course, you rightly mentioned the Iroquois, who govern even a larger area in western New York and northwestern Pennsylvania and going into Canada. And they did this as a league, as a combination of six different nations that somehow managed to ally and stay allied. How did they do that? And so that we were very curious. We white folks, and for that matter, black folks, were very curious about that. And that had an impact on European philosophers like Montesquieu and Montaigne and Locke, the British, and influenced their thinking that then became influential in our thinking. And these white folks that, with the wigs that you mentioned that come up with democracy. So there's an influence. Plus, there was a direct influence. Benjamin Franklin literally used the Iroquois influence as an example for our Articles of Confederacy. That's part of the story. And we don't really credit Native Americans with ideas. We do credit them with crops, which is new. We didn't even used to do that. You know, they invented corn, and they did. But we need to give them credit for some ideas and some interesting ones as well.
I remember from Lies that cartoonists used to use images of Native Americans to represent the colonies fighting against the British, which is
That's right.
A funny kind of thing. And yet, as time has gone on, that image has been shifted or distorted. And I guess acknowledging their influence on the very principles of the founding of the country, that would entail acknowledging the horror of what was done to them.
Well, you know what? If we did that, we might actually have to change the name of the National Football League team that's in our nation's capital.
Right.
And, of course, I'm referring to the Washington Redskins, you know. I mean, we don't got no team called the Atlanta Niggers or the Chicago Polacks or the New York City Hymies, you know. But here we use a racial slur for the team in the nation's capital, and we got away with it. Why? Well, because they ain't but about 1% of the whole population of the country. And here in D.C., they're nowhere near 1% of the population around here. So, yes, it is a racial slur, but by God, we didn't mean anything by it, and so we're just going to keep it.
Right.
Well, you know, if we really thought these folks are important people who had some good ideas, who maybe still have some good ideas, who maybe are part of our country, we need to think about them, well, then maybe we couldn't use that term.
Well, I keep coming back to Bill Kristol had a tweet that had some pretty hilarious responses to, in which he said, quote, "The left's 21st century agenda, expunging every trace of respect, recognition, or acknowledgement of Americans who fought for the Confederacy," close quote. And it just reminds me of the bigger critique. When you argue for a more clear-eyed assessment of U.S. actions in history, people say that you think that textbooks should be anti-American.
Yeah, that's the biggest criticism I get. And I actually have now been dealing with it in my own presentation. So I end with an American flag, and it says, patriotism, not nationalism. And here's what I say when I show that. It says, I take my definition of patriotism partly from Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass, and I say he was really good on women's rights, so please pardon him for using the he pronoun. He says, I call him a patriot who rebukes his country for its sins and does not excuse them. Now, by contrast, a nationalist says, what sins? We don't got no sins. And if we ever did anything wrong, it was completely by accident, we were innocent. And if you don't say anything else like that, we're going to fight. Well, I would submit to you that nationalism is not patriotic. We don't need nationalism. We need intelligent, informed patriotism.
We've been speaking with James W. Loewen from the University of Vermont. Thank you very much, James Loewen, for joining us today on Counterspin.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.